This is music from Edward Simon. Welcome to The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson. The Venezuelan pianist takes us on a musical tour of his country, from the joropo of the high plains to the merengue of the inner city, in his Venezuelan Suite. Guitarist Nir Felder ruminates about the golden age of music, MTV, and espresso. And first, we remember a poet, a playwright, an awe-inspiring author, and fearless activist from Newark, New Jersey, who passed away, Amiri Baraka. That's up next. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson. Thanks for checking in. Just 2 months ago, we commemorated Amiri Baraka for his work Blues People, a book he published over 50 years ago. Yet, those lessons endured. One reason why Blues People has remained in print for all these years. Amiri Baraka died January 9th, 2014. He was 79. Today, we rebroadcast that segment in honor of the man and his work. Amiri Baraka, what gave you the impetus to write Blues People?
I'd have to give the first, wave to my English professor, A.B. Spellman. You might have heard of him as a writer. He's a poet. Anyway, we were roommates at Howard, and, we thought we were so hip, that we knew everything. We heard Charlie Parker and Monk. I mean, we got so hip, we heard Dave Brubeck. Jazz at Oberlin. That's when I was in college. See how long ago that was. And Brown, who was my English professor, who was a very profound guy, he said, "You all know all about the music. Come to my house. I'll show you something." So we went over there. He had walls of records, 78s mostly. I think 45s was just coming out. I mean, he was playing blues. Oh, blues. And he said, "That's your history." I didn't really understand it thoroughly till about 10 years later. They're telling you their lives, dude. That's what the blues are. They keep telling you about their lives, where they came from, where they're going, what they expect, what life is like. So if you want to understand black history, you understand your own self's history, check out the blues. So when I got to New York, after flunking out of Howard, joining the Air Force, getting kicked out of the Air Force, it was two for two. I went to New York, and I got a job downtown at a place called a Record Changer, And it was a joint, really, where you would say the Moldy Figs hung out. They're really actually young white dudes who like Dixie. That's what they call it, Dixieland, So I was looking for a job. I went in there, I told the guy, I said, "Well, I don't know much about the music before Louis Armstrong." The guy said, "No one else does either." And I was the all-purpose shipping clerk, Not only had I to locate the records among these thousands of records, but I had to grade them. And I learned the old labels, Jeanette, Vocalion, Black Swan, all that. I learned who the stars of those records were. And I learned the history of the blues. And that was my gig. And that's how I learned it. So the interesting thing about that was a whole bunch of young white jazz critics hung there. Martin Williams. What's his name? Who was the head of the Institute of Jazz Studies?
Dan Morgenstern.
Dan Morgenstern. This is where they hung out. I was in there packing. They was in there. And we sit rapping all afternoon because they wasn't doing nothing. I don't know what they was doing. They was in college or this kind of job or that kind of job.
Give me a sample conversation. You say you were rapping. What would you guys be talking about?
Well, some of the stuff that turned out to be problematic to me, like Morgenstern would say, "Well, jazz stopped after Duke Ellington." And I said, "Wait a minute, man. I'm a bebopper, first of all, so that can't be true." or Martin Williams, who was my close friend. Martin said, you know, Billie Holiday wasn't a blues singer. But what are you talking about, man? But anyway, those kind of conversations would go on half of the day. There were some really heavy minds in there. And we talked, we talked, we talked. But what I found out is that I had different ideas about it. You know, for instance, I do think Billie Holiday is a blues singer. You know, I argued that it's not a form, Martin. It's not a form. It's a feeling. The form, that's formalism. You know, you could say, you could go 12 bars, A, B, A, B, and it won't be the blues if it don't have that. You know what I mean? And as far as jazz being dead, Dan, I, you know, that's just not real. I mean, you like that. But to tell me that Bird and them are not jazz is just not realistic. You know, I don't know. He altered his views later on, obviously. But they were good friends of mine, and the back and forth discussions, you know, with people who knew what was happening, you know. I have to clarify what I think about this. And so I began that year, it was 61, 62, to listen to blues all day, every day. From the oldest I could get through each period and begin to then classify them, understand them, you know. And then I wrote out the kind of précis, the kind of outline that I wanted to talk about. First of all, how did Africans get to be Afro-Americans?
When did a black American emerge, as
exactly,
you wrote?
Exactly. And that was, obviously, that for me, that was key right there. When do you, and can you tell that from the music? Obviously, if you listen to the music, you could tell it. The African forms, which are primary at one point, begin to recede. Because what's important, what was important to me is, when did the African slave become the American slave?
I've had a man of 15 years. Give him his room and board. Once he was like a hell like, now he's like an old worn-out Ford. He never brought me a lousy dime and put it in my hand. So there'll be some changes from now on according to my plan. He's got to get it, bring it, and put it right here, or else he's gonna keep it out there.
That's Bessie Smith. Put it right here or keep it out of there. An example of what Amiri Baraka calls classic blues. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of Blues People, the Negro experience in white America, and the music that developed from it. In Blues People, you say early blues developed as a music to be sung for pleasure, and that was its strength and its weakness. What do you mean by that?
Well, you couldn't make money from it, is what it meant. Until you had what they call classic blues, that period when the women and the jazz bands took it up, and then it could go to these vaudeville houses and on the road. It wasn't commercial in that sense, you know. That was because of slavery. When slavery is no longer, then that music doesn't have to stay on that plantation. You know, like the one-man band, where the even modern drum set comes from. That's a slave who didn't, coming off the plantation, he's got drums, cymbals, you know, all that stuff that he could put on himself. Those were commercial enterprises, in a sense, you know, no matter how small that revenue might have been from that, but that's what they were, you know.
You talk about the transition to classic blues, and it's primarily the female voice. It's people like Bessie Smith, and then Mamie Smith and Race Records.
Lovey Austin, you know, Trixie Smith, all those, Ma Rainey, all those people. Because they couldn't go anywhere, definitely couldn't go anywhere in the slave thing. That freed that thing, you know. Like they say, the productive forces were freed by the end of slavery, although they were capped by what we call the Sisyphus syndrome. You push the rock up the hill, they try to push it back down, you know. But that's still going on. The thing now is that there's so much stuff, you know, that people can't see what's really happening, you know. I mean, the problem with the corporate intervention in that, which changed, say, rap, took it another direction, you know. Early rap is not about get rich or die trying. That's something fueled by the corporations, you know, 50 Cent, Lil Wayne, and those people. Or even now you have Kanye West, who is selling Confederate flags, you know. I mean, that's... I mean, that's extraordinary, you know. But
I mean, when you look at something like that, do you say, we've come a long way, or what the hell is this?
Well, I wrote a poem about it that begins, who will be the first to slap the shit out of Kanye West? It's part of the whole post-Obama kind of miasma. What Obama thing did was remove, they thought, you know, post-racial. That's the kind of problem I'm on here, because a lot of these young kids really believe that, you know, it's straight ahead, you know, that there is no obstacles to them becoming Americans, you know.
Let's talk about today then, Amiri Baraka.
Yeah.
Because now, by and large, the amount of resources has continued to accrue to some degree. And so has the ability to connect with music around the world externally. So what does that mean for the blues aesthetic? Because I think a lot of people are concerned that there's a danger that it will get lost.
Yeah. Well, it certainly, first of all, is going to find all kinds of new ways to manifest itself. That's without doubt. The thing about the blues is that it's fundamental. It's like you're talking about the national code in your mind. Like in terms of my own understanding of the blues, I got that from home before I could say blues.
Quickly, I mean, what's a record that you remember your parents hearing?
Well, my parents would play people like Count Basie, Ella Fitzgerald. Nat King Cole was a favorite in our house before he started singing. And he was a great piano player, you know. Louis Jordan was a famous Caledonia, Caledonia will make your big head so hard. That's the cultural basket that you grew up in. Now there's more access to more different things. What will it result in? Well, I hope it don't just result in Kanye West. I hope we can develop access to the world without disposing of our own historic selves. First of all, everybody borrows from everybody. Every culture borrows from other ones.
Assimilation.
Always. There's no way you cannot have that. It's a good thing. Question is, why should the Beatles be making $1 billion and Blind Willie Jackson in Mississippi not making nothing in terms of that? That's a social question.
I think you're talking about fundamental differences between assimilation and appropriation.
Yeah. Well, appropriation is what they do. You know, I mean, even appropriate bodies and slavery. If you tell me I learned everything I know from Blind Willie Jackson, how come he poor and you rich? See, that's a social question. And that's got to be solved. It will be solved, but it's got to be solved.
Before you leave, Amiri Baraka,
yeah,
will you share a poem about music? Do you have one?
This is from a book called Wise, Wise, Wise. I got that from Langston Hughes. Langston said, if you ask why all the time, you'll get wise. Africa. Africa. Go back, Black Sea yourself. Africa. Creator of the human being. Of language. music, the city, beautiful ancient Africa. But when you put your hand on your sister, made her a slave, watch out, Africa. Watch out, Africa, the ghost gonna get you. When you put your hand on your brother, made him a slave, watch out, Africa. Ghost gonna get you. Ah! How'd you get here? On my back in the dark with the wind and water blowing through my ears. How'd I get here on my back? Shango about to last, save me, save me. Isa, save me, save me. How'd I get here on my back in the dark with the wind and water blowing through my ears? At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones. Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble. At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones. Black ivory. Wise one, if you ever find yourself somewhere lost and surrounded by enemies who won't let you speak in your own language, who destroy your statues and instruments, who ban your boom baboom, you're in trouble. They ban your boom baboom. You in deep, deep trouble. Huh. Probably take you several hundred years to get out. At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones.
Poet and author Amiri Baraka joined the ancestors January 9th, 2014. He was 79. We will always remember one of Newark's great intellectuals. Coming up next, Golden Age, according to guitarist Nir Felder. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson. Felder joins us on The Checkout again.
What's up, Josh?
How are you?
Doing great, man.
I haven't seen you. It's good to see you, too. You have a record out.
I do.
It's on OK Records. This is sort of the revitalized OK Records. They've been putting out quite a few recordings.
It is.
What is the golden age for you? You're too young. I mean, is this the golden age?
Oh, it's more of a question than a statement, I guess. when I was writing this music and recording this record, I was just, that phrase kept coming into my head. I was around 2010, 2011, a lot of stuff was going on in the world, financial crisis, Occupy Wall Street, Arab Spring. And I was just kind of wondering about where we were and where we were headed. And the idea of a golden age kept coming up to me. It's, you know, something that exists only in our imagination. You know, we've never seen one, so we project one into the future or into the past, you know, distant future, distant past. But it's something that we can all imagine in our heads right now. So it was kind of just a question, something I was thinking about.
I remember at some point, maybe this was around that time, you were using your Instagram account quite a bit and hashtagging golden age.
I did that a little bit. Just things that reminded me of either what people look at as a golden age of the past or something that was futuristic and seemed to conjure up a golden age imagery.
Describe some of those things that you took photographs of and gave it that appropriate hashtag.
Let me think. I remember one of, I really like good espresso. That's something that I, you know, have fun exploring New York City and finding some good espresso places. And there's one that has something called a Mod Bar, which is a very futuristic looking coffee making device. So that probably was one. I probably took a picture of a Mod Bar and, you know, hashtagged that golden age.
What makes a good espresso for you?
It's just the combination of the acidity of the espresso and the, you know, maybe the sweetness of the milk if you have a macchiato, which is my drink of choice.
Just a little stain of milk.
Just a little mark.
Nierfelder joins us on The Checkout, and Golden Age is the recording. Nier, talk a little bit about the group and what kind of sound are you going for?
Well, I guess I grew up in the 80s and kind of was babysat by MTV in the 80s. You know, my parents were both working. So that was really my first exposure to music because my parents weren't avid music listeners. So I got kind of hooked on that kind of sound of, you know, big 80s records, you know, and songs. And then I fell in love with jazz later on and blues and when I started playing guitar. And nowadays when I have a band, when I get to have my own band and write the music that I want to write, I still hear some of that, you know, song material in there, but with the flexibility of jazz. You know, I like to be able to kind of change directions when we all feel like it as a group. So these guys are really special. They're great friends, first and foremost, but they also have the ability to stay loyal to a song while being flexible. So if the mood wants to change from night to night or city to city, they can do that, but they know how to capture a mood. So they're really special guys. It's Aaron Parks on piano, Matt Penman on bass, and Nate Smith on drums.
When you talk about these bands that you were babysat by MTV in the 80s, who are they and who are some of the guitarists that you're like, man, aside from the hair, he's cool?
Well, MTV was really cool in the 80s. You know, they had kind of very diverse programming. So there'd be, my two favorite shows were Yo MTV Raps with Dre and Ed Lover and Headbangers Ball with Ricky Rockman. So like some of those videos, you know, it was 80s. So those would be the more like kind of low budget videos and kind of from some more independent divisions of record labels and stuff. So there were groups like The Far Side and Helmet and KMFDM that MTV was playing, you know, which they never would now. But it was cool to have that wide variety of music to be exposed to as a kid. And as far as guitar players, you know, all the great rock and roll guitar players, Angus Young and Slash and guys like that, Brian May from Queen, those guys that took these really melodic, very architectural guitar solos that were really part of the song. You know, you can't play those songs without that guitar solo. It wouldn't be that song anymore. So right. I think that kind of stuck.
And Brian May was an astrophysicist.
Oh, yeah. Jerk? No. Yeah, what a talented guy. And he also built his own guitar. The Red Special was built out of the mantle of a fireplace.
The mantle of a fireplace.
That's what that guitar is built out of.
Have you ever built your own guitar?
I haven't. No, I'm very lo-fi when it comes to guitars. I'm still playing the same Mexican Stratocaster I bought when I was 13 for $200 at Sam Ash. I like it. It's been played a lot. It's been worn in. It feels like my guitar, you know. It's not just off the rack, so.
Does the sonority of the instrument itself change? Does it age well?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, that people are very, you know, the vintage guitar market is very hot commodity. People, you know, want these really old instruments because they sound aged to them, I guess, worn in, warm.
Yeah, but a Gibson L5 versus a Mexican Strat maybe or something.
You know, I think it's very personal. You know, if a guitar really feels like yours and you've played it a lot, it's going to have that warm, personal sound that we all want. Thank you.
Neerfelder joins us on the checkout. Golden Age is the recording on OK Records. Do you have certain expectations as someone who is now on what is essentially a major label and one of the few left that's really kind of presenting and promoting jazz in any significant way in terms of, you know, getting out the word? When they launched this label, OK Records, I mean, that is an historic name.
Yeah.
And it has stood for something, you know.
Absolutely.
And so when they brought this back and revitalized this, what were your expectations?
I'm really grateful and pleased to be a part of this thing, and I think they're doing an amazing thing. They signed a lot of new artists, ones that a jazz audience might not be familiar with, and they took a great risk in doing that. And I think that says a lot about their mission here, is they're trying to curate kind of some of the new voices out there and just pick a few and give them a chance, which is a lot. So I'm very grateful to be part of that group. And as far as expectations, if you mean by success, I guess that's for the audience to decide. You know, if they like it, I'm thrilled.
As an artist in this kind of environment, I mean, brand is something that is one of the few things that you have, really, that you can cultivate.
I guess so. To me, it's still kind of a dirty word, right? Did you ever read No Logo by Naomi Klein?
No.
That's a really cool book, which I recommend, but it just discusses branding and the negatives of branding and branding at any cost. So, you know, when people talk about having yourself be a brand, that's scary to me because you're not. You're a human being. You know, you're not something that is sold and you know, that you wouldn't want to be.
You have to walk this fine line, though, because, yes, you make your art, but at the same time, you are making a fungible commodity in a marketplace.
Right.
How do you walk that line?
It's a difficult line to walk. That's a good question. I think that, you know, you have to stay true to yourself. And I think people, like we were talking about old school, people really value authenticity because it's rarer and rarer. So that usually involves kind of saying no to a lot of the things that people tell you you're supposed to do and trusting yourself, because there are questions that only you can answer for yourself. And as a musician, that honesty is what's critical to communicating. So if you can be honest with yourself about the music you want to make, I think people do value that.
Guitarist Neerfelder from his album Golden Age. Coming up next, Edward Simon's musical manifesto of his homeland, the Venezuelan Suite. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson.
Edward Simon, thank you for revisiting us here on The Checkout.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Josh.
Congratulations on what appears to be, on the surface, and quite possibly upon repeated listens, a fairly monumental project.
Indeed.
Tell us a little bit about the Venezuelan project.
Venezuelan project, it was born from my desire to consolidate my cultural heritage with my love for classical music and my experience in jazz. Since my second record, I have always recorded a Venezuelan folk song. This interest grew over time to the point where I felt, well, I need to really come head on with this Venezuelan music idea and write a piece that is actually based on Venezuelan rhythms and genres, as opposed to just adapting a folk melody into jazz.
I've been flirting with this for too long.
Yes, yes. I had to come face to face with it. So that gave the impetus for me forming Ensemble Venezuela, which is an ensemble that is dedicated to the exploration of the marriage between jazz and Venezuelan music by way of creating new works and arrangements of works by master Venezuelan composers.
You wrote a Venezuelan waltz for this suite, Mérida.
Yes. Mérida is the name of a city in Venezuela that's situated in the Andes. It's a very picturesque city in the mountains. The Venezuelan waltz just has this kind of elegance that you don't hear. Perhaps what might come closest to it is the Viennese waltz. And in fact, I think there is that European influence. It certainly exists in Venezuelan music, but in the case of the waltz, it may even be specific to the Viennese waltz. It's usually slow. And in the case of my waltz, it has a very lyrical melody. I thought it was a very important genre to have represented in the suite.
Thank you.
Mérida. Edward Simon joins us on the checkout. The Venezuelan Suite is the recording. One thing that fascinates me, Edward Simon, the topography of Venezuela, I think, speaks a lot about the actual music in as much as, you know, the people who inhabit those places. Talk to me about that sort of variation in what's not a small country, but smaller than us.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's a unique feature, I think, of Venezuela, the fact that it has such a varied topography. As you know, we have the Andes, as I've mentioned before. We have, of course, cities like Caracas, big cities. And in the cities, I think in Caracas in particular, is where the merengue evolved. It's more of an urban genre of music. And we also have the plains, which run through the middle of the country and is where a lot of the farmland is. The state that covers most of that region is called Barinas. And the capital of that state is the city by the same name, Barinas. And that's the name of the first movement of the suite, which is written in the style of a joropo, which is Venezuela's national rhythm.
What's distinguishable about that rhythm? Like, what makes it its own version of, is it clave?
And it's not clave-based. It's in 3/4 time. Most of Venezuelan folk music is trinary, meaning it's either in 3/4 or 6/8 or in some kind of division of,
okay,
three.
Very similar to like Argentina and the chacarera.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. With the exception of the merengue that I mentioned previously, that's in 5/8. I think historically that used to also be in 6, but it got shrunk into 5/8 as it evolved. So it's a very unique form that you don't find anywhere else. And the joropo in 3/4, it's has a very lively, a lot of vitality rhythmically. And it has a specific kind of dance that goes with it. And it has these accents that are typically on beats 3 and 1.
Let's hear just a taste of that. Barinas. Barinas from the Venezuelan Suite, Edward Simon joins us here on The Checkout. Let's finish up with the merengue. I didn't even know what you said earlier, that this thing started out in 6/8 and gets truncated into 5/8. How do you do that?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Josh. I think it was probably a natural evolution of the genre. Initially, it was played more as a 6/8 groove of some sort, and somehow it evolved to where the 6-beat just got shrunk in. And these days is played pretty strictly as a 5/8.
But this fundamentally alters the syncopation in it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the bass never plays on the 1, which makes it very difficult for other people to learn how to play this style who didn't grow up playing in this tradition. And in fact, many of the bassists that I've played this suite with have had a great difficulty playing the merengue in particular, because it's enough to be playing in 5/8, which is already kind of an unusual time signature for us here in the U.S. But to play it where the bass doesn't play on the 1, which the 1, as you know, serves as
home.
Yeah, it's a kind of our orientation for us in music. Well, the bass never plays on the 1, it plays on 2 and 4 and 5. So it's really highly syncopated. And then all the stuff that happens on top of it, it's incredibly elaborate and sophisticated rhythmically. Of course, if you were to speak to a folk musician, he would have no idea what...
What are you talking about? I just do this.
This is a merengue. You know, they play it as naturally as we tap our feet on 2 and 4 when we hear swing.
Yeah. Let's talk about what you do with that merengue in the Venezuelan suite.
Mostly what I've done is I've taken the rhythm and used it as the basis for this composition, for this particular movement. I used elements of the melodic content that you would typically find in a merengue. The melodic and the rhythmic material is derived directly from that genre. The harmonic material, comes from the jazz language. So there is where I've combined the two languages. And in general, I find that that's what gives some of the best results, because jazz has such a rich harmonic language. And Latin American music in general has such vitality rhythmically that when you put the two together, it can provide the most beautiful result, I find. And then on top of that, to bring in that aspect of moment-to-moment interreaction that we find in jazz and very sophisticated improvisations. So those are the things that I was after in this suite.
Let's hear Caracas. Caracas, Edward Simon. Music from the Venezuelan Suite. So I have to ask you, Edward, where is home for you? Where is the downbeat for you? Is it on the one for jazz, or is it on 2, 4, 5, or somewhere else?
Well, in jazz, we actually also like to hide the one. We have to know where it is to have our grounding, but we don't play on it. It's part of the idiosyncrasy of the music, rhythmically. So it's interesting that we were talking about that before in the merengue. You know, there's some kind of connection there. For me, I always like to know where the one is, but not reveal it. You're constantly trying to hide it somehow, and that's where the syncopation comes in. You either play on the end of one or on the end of the previous beat. So that's part of how we do it.
Well, when it comes to folkloric music of Venezuela, or what we call jazz, we'll keep your motivation hidden, Edward Simon. Which one you truly love more? I think we hear a bit of the answer in the Venezuelan Suite. Thank you for joining us on the Checkout.
My pleasure, Josh.
Music from Edward Simon's Venezuelan Suite, featuring Ensemble Venezuela with Adam Cruz, Marco Granados, Leonardo Granados, Edmar Castañeda, John Ellis, and Roberto Koch. The Checkout is a podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes or stream all of the programs online at checkoutjazz.org. Follow us on Twitter at checkoutjazz. Producer is Simon Rentner. He's on Twitter at Simon Rentner. Special thanks to our intern, Joyce Kwan. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Josh Jackson. Thanks for listening.